Hi, and welcome to Emetophobia Help. I'm Anna Christie, recovered emetophobic and licensed psychotherapist specializing in emetophobia. These podcasts have a trigger warning of words associated with emetophobia. If you enjoy these podcasts or you find them helpful, you can buy me a coffee. Just scroll down in the notes, click on the link, and for a couple of bucks, you can support the podcast. This podcast was recorded in 2021 and, due to my error only, never published until now. Hello, Dr. Solomon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm good. Chilly a little bit.
Yeah. So I'm here with Dr. Allison Solomon, who is a licensed clinical psychologist and founder of the Virtual Center for Anxiety and OCD. And you're in New York, Long Island, you were saying, but you do virtual. You're licensed in 23 other states as well to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Mostly a lot of Arizona patients I see, because that's where I was physically located for a long time. So, right now, New York and Arizona, I don't see many people from the other states I'm licensed in, just because I'm full. But actually, I see someone in Georgia and someone in Florida, but mostly.
Well, can you tell us a little bit, first of all, before we get into the emetophobia stuff, about your practice in general? What do you mainly do?
So I have a pretty specialized practice. I really only see OCD, anxiety disorders such as phobias, generalized anxiety, and then I see tic disorders like Tourette syndrome, and body-focused repetitive behaviors, or BFRBs, which are skin picking, hair pulling. And they're all, most OCD and anxiety specialists, those are pretty common clusters. But I really developed a subspecialty in emetophobia. So even though those are pretty much my areas of treatment at any given time, usually about 50% of my caseload is emetophobia.
Wow. That's,
and I treat kids and adults. So it's, and that's kind of split too. I kind of, at any given time, it's, you know, strange how I almost always have about 50-50 kids, adults. It just kind of works out that way.
Right. And do you, and also adolescents, when you say
yes.
Kids?
Yeah. Kids, teens, adolescents. And then I also do a program called SPACE. I don't know if you've heard of the SPACE program.
I have not. I don't think.
Oh, it's great. So it stands for Supportive Parenting of Anxious Children's Emotions. And it was developed by Eli Leibovitz at Yale. And basically, it is a way of working with parents only for about their children with anxiety, OCD, emetophobia, and really it's almost like almost ERP for the parents, where parents having a hard time, you know, not accommodating their child's anxiety and children refusing school, refusing to do certain things. And so really it's all working with parents, and I find it a really awesome approach, because a lot of kids sometimes refuse therapy, or maybe too young to engage in therapy. And, you know, teens, especially if they don't want treatment, they're not being forced to have treatment. So it's a great way of, you know, it's an empirically validated way of treating anxiety disorders and OCD. So that's another.
I have to learn more about this. That sounds fantastic. My first training was in family systems theory, and I was a family therapist. And so I still integrate that somewhat into the work I do, but it's pretty pretty standard CBT now, but that sounds great. I mean, I am always, when I was working with children, I was always talking with parents as well, definitely, because, and then a lot of them are online and various Facebook groups, parents that just don't know what to do. And for the most part are probably doing things that are seem like the right thing, like reassuring kids, right? And you have to be a bit counterintuitive. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that.
But. 100%. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, we know anxiety is genetic too. So a lot of times, even if a parent doesn't have specific, you know, anxiety or emetophobia, you might be anxious about making your kids anxious. And so withdrawing accommodations, you know, refusing to give reassurance or picking a child up from school when they're worried about something, you know, it can be really challenging for parents. And we all want to make our kids feel relaxed and calm and safe. But it is counterintuitive when it comes to treating anxiety disorders. So it's a great program. Definitely look it up. And
I've forgotten what the E stands. Is there an E at the end?
Yeah, it's emotions. I'm looking
emotions.
For.
Okay. Yeah, that's all right. I'm sure I can.
I have one of his. Oh, here. This is one for your listeners, actually. It's
Breaking Free of Child Anxiety and OCD. If you could lift it up a little bit higher, a scientifically proven program for parents by Eli R. Leibowitz, PhD. Look, that looks like a great book.
So that's his book on the SPACE program. And then there's training for therapists specifically in the SPACE program. And actually, I'm excited, and this kind of goes in with emetophobia, but I'm taking an advanced SPACE program training on using SPACE for ARFID, which is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder for listeners.
Yes, which a lot of emetophobic kids have, sometimes for no other reason than they're afraid of throwing up, you know, basically.
Yeah.
It's not for any other reason, but
I see ARFID, and that's really the only eating disorder that I treat, just because I don't feel competent in, I always refer out for other eating disorders, but you know, ARFID, when it's due to emetophobia or OCD specific fears or other phobias, like fears of choking, things like that, that's when I will treat ARFID.
Right. How did you get into treating emetophobia?
Well, so when I was younger, I have a younger sister. She's actually learning to be a therapist now. She changed careers this past year. She was publicity for a very long time, or PR, and she decided she's always been interested in this. So she's switching. So she actually had OCD and Tourette syndrome growing up, and does have emetophobia now, somewhat, very manageable. But when she was younger, she didn't really have emetophobia. That wasn't one of her big ones. So, but I just became really interested in OCD and anxiety, and then just through coincidences as well, when I was in graduate school, there were a few faculty members that did a lot with OCD, and I did some practicum placements in like a child anxiety and OCD clinic and things like that. And then I started pretty quickly, even before I graduated, seeing cases of emetophobia. And then it just kind of built from there.
Wow. Well, that's really great that you got into this field because it sure is needed, as I'm sure you know that that's one of the things I'm trying to do all the time is get
more therapists
on my, I haven't updated my list for a long time. I've been so, what is the word? Delinquent or something like that in updating my website. But I really, you know, last time I updated it, there are only like 55 therapists on that list. Now, I know there are hundreds more out there. I know there are. It's just a matter of finding them and having one list would be great for people to be able to go to.
Are you a member of the Facebook group I run?
And which one is that?
OCD Anxiety BFRB Specialists?
I don't think so.
I run a Facebook group for OCD and anxiety and BFRB specialist, and there's about 2,000 of us, and almost all of us treat emetophobia.
Wow, that's just so awesome!
Yeah, I need a secretary now.
I need a secretary to put it on a spreadsheet. Yeah.
Well, actually, we can make a spreadsheet if you want. We have spreadsheets already, so if you join, we can have people list if they treat emetophobia and what ages and
telehealth and everything. I do get a lot of hits on my website because it was probably the first one that was ever up about emetophobia. And that was back in, I don't know what year, maybe 2000. I started with just like a little Weebly website in around 2003 or four. And 2010, I would have switched to a more complicated, like a WordPress site or something. And I do have about 10,000 backlinks on that site.
That's awesome.
Which I haven't sought any of them, but those are probably therapists that link to it to use the free resources on the site. Mm-hmm. Right?
So, I remember discovering your website years and years ago and before we ever touched base, and it was, I'm so grateful for it. It was so helpful. And it's one of the websites that I find a lot of people mentioning you or mentioning the website because that was how they knew that was emetophobia was a thing.
Right. That's right. This is a thing. Yeah. It's a thing that's, I was just, I'm writing a book for therapists. It'll be published by Jessica Kingsley Press in the UK, probably in about a year and a half from now. We're just signing contracts.
Exciting.
So the manuscript is done. David and I are just working on, you know, fixing it and things like that. But what was my point? I had a point other than to plug a book that's not even published yet. I can't remember. I think just the fact that there weren't even any published books until 2021 when Lovitz and I forget the other name, they published Gag Reflections, and then thankfully Dr. David Veal and Dr. Alexander Keys in the UK, also with Jessica Kingsley, published their wonderful work called Free Yourself from Emetophobia. And at the same time, another therapist in California self-published a book called The Emetophobia Manual, which is also very good. It's a little bit, Ken Goodman is his name.
Yes, he's a member of my Facebook group, I believe.
Probably, yeah. His book is it's good. It's a little more folksy, a little more fun to read. But it could be a little bit triggering if anybody's out there listening, and really, he does put a lot of triggering words and stories at the beginning. So I always say, start with Free Yourself from Emetophobia.
And then there's Guts for Kids. I don't know if you've read that book. One.
Yes, actually, I've got a whole bunch of, I went on Amazon one time and got any book that had anything to do with vomit for kids, and I purchased them all. And someday I'm going to actually read them, review them, and put them up on my website.
I have all these to-dos. I actually have one of these kind of virtual sticky notes on my website, now on your desktop. Yeah. And I have just links to every emetophobia exposure video. Oh, and I have a whole collection.
That's great. And of course, David Russ, who's writing the book with me, he put out the program, the Turnaround Anxiety Program.
I know of Turnaround. Absolutely. Yeah, I have it. I've recommended it.
Good. And he put out an emetophobia supplement a few years later.
Right.
And then he's just self-published a children's book on emetophobia as well, which is very good. It's very, very good. He's really good with kids. But just a little break halfway through to let you know about resources that you can find. First of all, I teach a set of 10 classes for people with emetophobia, and you can find information about those on my website at emetophobiahelp.org. I also have a Facebook group called Emetophobia No Panic, and you can look that up on Facebook. If you're listening as a therapist, there is a free website for you at emetophobia.net. It has all the resources you need for free to treat emetophobia. Dr. David Russ, child psychologist, and I recently published a book called Emetophobia, Understanding and Treating Fear of Vomiting in Children and Adults, and it's available at all online booksellers. And now back to our podcast. Back to you though. This is the most important thing. Tell us a little bit about how you treat emetophobia, because people are always wanting to know what goes on.
Okay. Well, I think I conceptualize and treat emetophobia in most cases very similarly to OCD. And in some cases, it actually is OCD when there's, sometimes magical thinking involved, things like that.
Rituals
and even some emetophobia safety behaviors we can conceptualize them as rituals. Same thing with, OCD, where there's avoidance of certain things or eating when it's you don't want to feel too full or too hungry. It's just a sensation of, I have to get this just right feeling. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it can be, straight up OCD. But I think that speaks to the first step that I really do when treating emetophobia or really anything, is do a really thorough assessment. And, even if someone's coming to me for emetophobia, we know that other anxiety disorders are common. And so we also really want to do a thorough diagnostic assessment. Plus, it's depressing, having severe emetophobia, and it can limit and isolate you socially. So I always look to see, is there depression here? Are there any other things that we need to focus on? We do a really in-depth assessment. That way, we can determine what the best course of action for someone to be successful is. Because as exposure and response prevention, or ERP, is really the gold standard of treatment for emetophobia. But I found that if someone is incredibly depressed, so much so that they're having such a hard time functioning just with the depression, then we're going to want them to get the best success out of ERP. So we're going to start by focusing a little bit on the depression to make sure that they're able to stay motivated during exposures. And, it's hard work, and, I don't want anyone to get discouraged if things aren't happening right away. So sometimes just taking that extra time to do a longer assessment, and that's really my first step then I tend to provide a lot of psychoeducation mm-hmm. about, you know, the different ways emetophobia can kind of take place, I guess the word would be, how it manifests itself mm-hmm. in different mm-hmm. people, and, you know, educating about safety behaviors and avoidance and all of the things that we do to feel better, but it actually maintains the fear. Mm-hmm. And I also do a lot with ACT and willingness and yes. education around that. And then we
ACT, if I could just interrupt quick.
Sure.
ACT is acceptance and commitment therapy. Yes. Mm-hmm. Which is they call it the third wave of CBT. Yeah.
Yes.
It's further research into things that work. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I find ACT to be a great complement to ERP, mm-hmm. Especially, you know, everyone by now knows kind of the key term mindfulness, everything's yeah. about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ACT really, I like the way it harnesses mindfulness and, you know, helps engage you in building a life toward your values, living your values. And a lot right. of times our fears get in the way of us mm-hmm. living a valued life and doing the things mm-hmm. that we really care about. And so ACT is a really beautiful way to incorporate that and help motivate people to face mm-hmm. their fears and work through right. some of this and get to do all mm-hmm. the good stuff that comes yeah. with yeah. getting back into life.
A lot of it is goal setting. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that you, and everybody, the course that I first talked to, and yourself, I'm sure, is the same. They all say, my goal is not to have emetophobia. You know, like not to yeah. be anxious. And it's like, yeah, okay, like we're just gonna, that's already printed, you know, mm-hmm. on the form. So let's add some more things that you wish you could do, but you can't do them right now because mm-hmm. of your emetophobia. You know, measurable things, right? SMART mm-hmm. goals, as they call them. And don't ask me what the SMART stands mm-hmm. for. I'll fumble it up.
But specific, measurable.
Right?
I know there's a realistic in there.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
But yeah.
It's good. And I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah. That's a good
goals. Yeah.
Now I want to Google it. But yeah, I as know, far as yeah. ACT, if you think of, you know, if you think of being a mom, you know, you might not necessarily want to, you know, clean diapers or change dirty diapers. And I'm sure people before they had kids would easily shy away from it. But then when it's your yeah. baby and your value is, mm-hmm. I want to make my baby feel safe and nurtured and loved, and I want to be the one to take care of them, then that's your value. And it's mm-hmm. much easier to do hard things in service of living the life that you want to live. And
right. Yes. Yeah. I find that people's goals, it's either to have children when they're afraid to get pregnant and afraid to mm-hmm. have children, but lots and lots and lots and lots of emetophobic people have children. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps it is to travel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe if you don't have kids or you're a bit younger, that's really a goal, and that traveling by airplane or any mode mm-hmm. of transportation is really scary. So those are things that both of those things are great goals to either mm-hmm. of them, I should say, you know, and then there are a whole range, caring for elderly parents, perhaps, mm-hmm. or all kind, maybe becoming a nurse. I've had nursing students. There are several nurses I noticed on my Facebook group that the group I just started called emetophobia, no panic. It's not, you can't go there and panic or tell your, or censor words and tell, you know, vomit stories. But other than that, you can talk about recovery and so on. Mm-hmm. A lot of nurses. Yeah. Quite a few nurses. And we have,
I actually have quite a few. Yeah. Now that you say that, mm-hmm. I probably have seen a lot, quite a few nurses.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think maybe if I could go back to when I was 18, I would have loved to have become a doctor, but I didn't even want to take science in university because I didn't want someone to throw up when they cut open a raccoon or whatever it is, whatever it is, you know, I didn't want to be there for, I mean, I could cut open the raccoon by myself, but yeah. So I think the medical field is very appealing to a lot of people, mm-hmm. and this phobia just gets in the way.
Definitely.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit more about, and this is maybe just for me, because I worked with adolescents for a short period of time, a couple of years, and then I stopped because I really felt like I needed some kind of specialized training to work with adolescents because they were often quite resistant. They didn't want to be there. They didn't mm-hmm. really want, all they wanted to do was avoid what, you know, what they're afraid of. Kids were fine. I could work with kids, no problem. But can you talk about how you work with teenagers and what kinds of things you do?
Yeah. I think I really see a variation. Before I was, you know, extremely specialized in anxiety and OCD, you know, I saw a lot of teens just coming in for, you know, maybe just stressful circumstances, or their parents were worried about them, or things like ADHD and difficulty at school. And what I noticed is when I saw teens more generally, there were much more teens that didn't really want treatment or want mm-hmm. help. With OCD and anxiety and emetophobia, I would say for the most part, they're pretty motivated to get help, but they're just terrified. And
mm-hmm. you're right.
And so I think the number one thing that I always say, well, I say this to adults too, but I don't necessarily need to say it. Whenever I meet a teenager or child and I tell them about, you know, provide a lot of education and normalize it and mm-hmm. all of that stuff. And I always say, you are the boss. We mm-hmm. are never going to do something that right. you are not willing to do.
Excellent.
Your parents and I, we're not going to trick you. Mm-hmm. We're not going to sneak around and be like, guess what? See, you did it. mm-hmm. There's not going to be any of that. You're the boss. But I do create a reward system. In fact, today, earlier, I met with, like, I think 15-year-old, and they were giving me their rewards list. So what I do is the first time I meet them and I do the assessment, and I tell them kind of about what we're going to be doing. I have them before the next session, I say, I want you to come up with a list of rewards or privileges on a menu, and I want them to be small, medium, and large. Okay. So like appetizers, main courses, and desserts. And then they have to be able to pass their parents,
right,
you know, authorization. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I basically tell them everything that you do, even though you want to get better, you want to get help yourself, you're still going to get points towards it. And so in that category, they get to choose, you know, what they're going to use their points for. And I tell parents, no matter what they do, if they break some rules or whatever, once they earn points, they can't lose them. They mm-hmm. can lose the thing that they earned. And
right,
but they can't lose points. So it's not like, oh, well, I got all these points for doing exposures, but I didn't do my homework, so now my mom took away all my points.
Oh, no.
Because that ends up being
Yeah.
Not so helpful. No. So usually that as a motivator, and then letting them be in the driver's seat.
Right.
I also find usually any kid or teen, there's something that they're super interested in, or mm-hmm. whether it's a certain video game or music or sports or movies. And I'll usually try to incorporate that into the theme of what we're doing.
Okay.
So, you know, it might be if someone's into, you know, Minecraft, we might, you know, make Minecraft characters throw up and.
Oh, can you do that? That is cool.
Yeah, there's all different stuff, or we might like, you know, contaminate Minecraft characters and then right. they have them in whatever, but anything that they yeah. get to really do something that's kind of fun within a theme mm-hmm. of something and just make it more interesting. Right. So there's that also, you know, just any different little ways to make things engaging, and the reward system definitely helps. But with adolescents and teens, a big part of it is working with the parents too, and yeah. mm-hmm. making sure the parents know everything that they need to be doing and practicing. And so a lot of times I'll do parent only sessions. And then depending on the kids, some kids only want to see me with their parents. They're totally right. fine yeah. having their parents there the whole time. Mm-hmm. And other kids never want their parents right. to be yeah. there. So,
yeah.
But involving family, siblings, you know, as much as we possibly can. And then also involving school.
Right. Yeah, that's big with kids. It can be teachers, principals, mm-hmm. protocols that might help or work or don't help at school. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot to it, that's for sure. And I certainly understand that you treat other anxiety disorders as well. But I wanted to ask you, with OCD and emetophobia, the current research is showing us that there is some sort of relationship there, that there really aren't any people with emetophobia that don't have some symptoms of OCD. And now I'm not mm-hmm. just talking about hand washing, because right. that's sort of a different thing. There are emetophobics who obsessively hand wash,
right.
and there are others who just seem to hand wash a lot, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. But what do you have any ideas or thoughts about what the relationship between OCD and emetophobia might be?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think about truly what is OCD, so it's unwanted thoughts, worries, concerns, fears, right? In the same way as emetophobia. The thought right. of like, what if this bad thing happens? What if mm-hmm. I throw up? What if I get sick? What if I get food poisoning? So mm-hmm. that's really not any different from any other anxiety disorder, really. It's right. that mm-hmm. fear part. The part that I think makes OCD different is that there's the ritualistic part. And so a lot of us think of, you know, rituals, especially in kind of common media movies. If you mm-hmm. don't know someone with OCD, the common ones are like, you know, cleaning, washing, counting, repeating things, stuff like that, yeah. checking. Mm-hmm. But what I've noticed is a emetophobia, you know, there are a lot of sub rituals that are not necessarily picked up on. So for, or thought of as rituals, for example, body scanning.
Right.
As the same way you would check a stove over and over again to make mm-hmm. sure mm-hmm. it's off, you can be checking, you know, am I bloated? Am I hungry? Do I feel nauseous? Do I have a fever?
Yeah.
So in that way, that is a ritual, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it goes above and beyond a safety behavior, mm-hmm. you know? So really, I think emetophobia, I think it should be thought of as a sub theme of OCD.
Yeah. So that was actually Dr. David Veal and another group of people. I'm sorry, I only remember him because I know him. And he's doing a lot of the research lately. But they found that in one of the studies that they thought that maybe that was true. His latest, when I talked to him on the podcast here, he thought that it would kind of OCD, like it kind of ran on a continuum with pure OCD at one end and pure emetophobia at the other. And most people mm-hmm. are, you know, somewhere on that continuum. So,
that's interesting. I definitely think emetophobia is more nuanced and complex than other phobias because I treat a lot of phobias and you don't see the amount of safety behaviors and the amount of mental rumination and rituals that you do with other phobias, like, you know, fear, like claustrophobia or fear of needles, things like that. Most other phobias, I wouldn't say most, I would say many other phobias, a lot of the response to that is pure avoidance.
Yes.
And a lot of panic. But emetophobia, there's lots of very complicated safety behaviors and.
And you, so many, it's, you know, if you want to avoid flying on an airplane for the rest of your life, you can probably do that. And then you never think about it. So there are periods of almost what I would call mental and emotional rest. You know, like there isn't a dog. I'm inside my house. I don't have a dog. And so my dog phobia is at rest. You know, I'm not thinking about it. I'm, you know, maybe it's going to freak me out when I go out to get the mail. But with emetophobia, it is 100%. 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
If you want to call
you can't run away from having a stomach.
No, nausea or maybe nausea or something like that. And so, and every time you eat, three times a day, every day. And, you know, so I think one of the things we say about it in our book is just that a lot of therapists don't realize how severe it is. Like how strong of a panic response people are getting from something that, you know, a lot of folks say, oh, well, no one likes to vomit. Well, no, that's true. But most people don't absolutely panic 10 out of 10 anxiety at the thought of it.
Absolutely.
At the thought of it only. So, yeah.
And I think a lot of therapists, And I do work, you know, training other therapists and consulting on cases. And I'm actually starting an emetophobia case consult. I have one now that I run, but I'm starting up another one for specialists for case consultation. But one of the things that is a mistake that I see, or not necessarily a mistake, an area that a lot of therapists don't know is how severely impacted people can be. I've worked with people who can't leave their home, kids who can't go to school. You know, you can, it can be as severe as it is. People who have had to have feeding tubes because they won't eat on their own.
Yeah, they can't hold down a job because they take so many sick days.
Absolutely.
Or panic,
So I think it's really important and you're doing this great work of educating, you know, it saves so many people, you know, if you have a caseload, if a therapist has a caseload and you even of 20, 40, 50 people and you educate that one therapist, that in turn is helping so many people. But, the other thing that I think it's related and to OCD is I do think biologically and genetically it's related. And so usually when I do, an assessment, I always ask, is who in your family has had, anxiety? Has anyone had OCD? Even if you don't know that they're diagnosed with anything, do you, what sounds familiar? And almost always I feel that if someone has emetophobia or OCD or vice versa, there's usually a family history of someone somewhere that
thing. Mm-hmm. Or even depression. The reason why I tell folks the reason why the SSRI drugs work on both depression and anxiety is that they're kind of two sides of a pancake.
And you might
have just one side of the pancake or the other, or you might have the whole pancake, which is where we kind of started off talking about people who have depression as well as, and I'm at the point now where I can't really work with people with depression. So I have to refer them to a therapist, of which there are millions. So that's not too bad, and have their depression, work on their depression so that they feel like they can tackle this difficult work.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I prefer, if someone's coming to me and depression is primary, and it may take a while to treat, sometimes I will refer out because I have a long wait list. And, if there's a lot of people that can treat depression, then, I'll have someone treat their depression if they're not ready to yet do ERP for their emetophobia. And that way I can get someone in, and then when they're ready, they can see me.
Absolutely. Are you listening from down under? If so, I have a set of emetophobia classes, 10 classes that I'm conducting beginning in January on a Wednesday afternoon here in Vancouver at 4 o'clock, which I believe is 9 o'clock in the morning in Sydney, Australia. It is also 7 p.m. Eastern. If anyone is interested in these classes, the information is on my website at emetophobiahelp.org.